Let's remember together some of the greatest TV and movie stars of yesteryear with the woman who knew them. Mary Jane Popp hosted radio and TV shows for nearly 5 decades, meeting these stars and getting them to share their real-life stories. You'll meet them up close and personal as Mary Jane searches her extensive archives for the best and brightest real star talk on Pop Star Talk. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
Well, here we are again with Pop Star Talk. I'm Mary Jane Popp with my producer, Kenneth Segura Knoll, to share another visit from way back when with celebrities that we all got to know on the big and small screen. Now, this week takes us to a beloved TV series with the Ingalls family. Can you guess which series that was? Hi, Ken. I bet you can remember the series.
Oh, of course. Little House on the Prairie.
And it's still going strong. It's still, you know, in reruns. Melissa Gilbert, we've had her on the show when she was coming through Sacramento, and she played, instead of Laura Ingalls, she played the mom on the stage production of Little House on the Prairie. So, yeah, it's still going strong simply because, it was family-oriented. You got to go into their family every week, and it was a time when you wanted to find out what the family was doing. You cared about the family. Those were the series back in the 70s and 80s. This one ran 1974 to 1983. It's amazing. And of course, we're going to be talking to, one of the brats. And well, let's get right to it, because you got to hear this gal. She talks like a shotgun. Unbelievable. I thought I talked fast. Nope. I met my match. This great personality was called nasty, hateful, a hellcat, and someone you just wanted, might want to smack. But viewers loved her all the same. We knew her as Nellie Olson, but Alison Arngrim created her on this iconic series. Hi, Alison. How are you?
Hi. I am very good. How are you?
Hanging in there. I'll tell you, I still love watching Little House on the Prairie, and I love your character. You were so good. I mean, people still, you say, sometimes shy away from you. That means you were really good in your part.
I really made an impression. You know, when I was talking about this the other day with Dean Butler, our lovely old man, that, you know, Little House was such an emotional show that I think people just zoomed into it on an emotional level and suspended all disbelief, just a sort of visceral reaction. So there I was being horrible. Maybe it was another show. People would have said, oh, she's a good actress, but it was Little House. So they just said, I hate her. That was that.
It's amazing. But, you know, really being that, how did you come about? How did you develop the character? Was it you that wanted to be nasty, or was that part of the script?
Oh, no. If you read the books, as Laura Ingalls explained, Nellie was pretty bad. She's kind of based on three people, really.
Oh.
Laura Ingalls Wilder was, when she was living in Walnut Grove, Minnesota, where the third book, Banks of Plum Creek, takes place, which they based the show on. Nellie Owens was an actual girl she went to school with, the Owens family, who ran the store. And Nellie was very spoiled. She was quite awful. But when she wrote the book, she changed the name because she thought Nellie might come after her.
Yeah.
And then she, in the book, you know, the family, the Ingalls, moved to South Dakota. Well, people were writing in and asking for more Nellie because it was such a great character because she was so awful. And so she really had to make stuff up. So she decided that Genevieve Masters and Stella Gilbert, who were other girls who were dreadful, she combined them into one person, so Nellie Olson suddenly appears in the books in South Dakota. So Nellie Olson was already a character in the books of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who was fairly well-hated. But she was only a certain level of rotten. So I get the part, and I go, wow, this girl's the villain. This girl's, the audition. I go to the audition. I hadn't read the books.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know there was Nellie. I get there, and I read the pages of the audition. I turned to my father and said, this girl is awful. She's a bitch. And my father said, what are you talking about? And I read it for him, and he starts laughing. He says, you read it just like that. Don't change anything. Don't change anything. Just do it. Don't even rehearse it. And I went and I read it for Michael Landon, the other producers, and they couldn't stop laughing. They hired me on the spot.
Really?
So I went, okay, she's bad. And I kind of escalated it. I made, I guess, a little worse. And then I'd get the script, the next script. And, well, she got worse and worse. And by the, you know, the third season, there I am pretending to be paralyzed and being pushed down a hill in a wheelchair, which definitely was not in the book. So she was terrible in the books, and I made her worse.
Well, you were the triple threat is what you were. That's it. That's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
I can't believe 50 years ago. It's an anniversary now, right? The 2024?
This is so, so crazy. Here we are. It is 2024. Show aired in 1974. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Little House on the Prairie. We can't believe it. None of us can believe it. We're like, how did this even happen? Where did 50 years go? Yeah. This is totally insane.
How old were you when you started, Nellie?
I was 12. So, yes, I'm 62 now.
Hey, you look dynamite, babe.
Well, thank you. I try. I do my best. It's absolutely amazing. 50 years, and we never believe we're making the show that people would still be watching us 50 years later.
If they are.
Because, you know, when we were filming, there was no cable TV, let alone DVDs or VHS or any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So it was just a shock to all of us that this show lasted this long and that all of these people are still into it. We just never imagined it. So here we all are. And having these events all over the country. Dean Butler's got a book coming out. We're doing autograph shows and historical prairie events in every state in the U.S. I'm heading out to France. I started booking my stand-up show, as they often do, but because it's the 50th, everyone's gone wild and they're all sold out. It's just amazing.
Now, let me ask you, did you do your stand-up one-woman show in
Correct.
French? How the heck did you do that?
Well, I've been doing my show. I've been doing stand-up off and on since I was a teenager, and I started doing this one-woman show, Confessions of Prairie Bitch, in about 2002. And I went to France around that time and found out that the show was a hit in France, that they just can't get enough Nellie Olson, that it's just a huge hit. Or as I like to say, they don't think Nellie Olson's mean. They think she's French.
I love it.
I thought, well, I got to get in on this. This is fantastic. So, I met this guy in France, Patrick Lebatier, and he said, we could do an adaptation of your one-woman show. We have to change things. Well, you're saying things that don't even make sense in French. It doesn't work. So he writes an entire show. So I wind up doing a show in French, and he's in it too, because he would come out and explain things. And then I come out, and I tell a story, and then we run a video clip, and then he tells the story. Just goes a mass panic, huge hit. So then, a couple of years later, he writes another show, Le Mal au Trésor de Nellie Olson, which is Nellie Olson's Drunk of Treasures. We do this show for a while. We now have a brand new show we just started doing last year, Nellie Olson en Flamme, Les Années 80, which is Nellie Olson lights up the 80s, aspires to the 1980s.
Wow.
It's so funny. There's stuff about Little House, and then there's stuff about just the 80s and crazy 80s trivia and game shows. It's really, really fun.
You're still taking, I mean, you're on the road like I've never seen anybody on the road.
I just got back. I keep looking, go, what day is it? Oh, yeah, I got back Tuesday night.
All right, and then you're going to, the 31st, you're back out again.
Exactly. I'm off to Kansas. I'm going to say the Independence, Kansas, which is where, you know, because the first book was Little House in the Big Woods, and it's Little House in the Prairie, and then that book, that's like the pilot episode of the show where Laura and her family go to Independence, Kansas and build up that house. The Independence, Kansas is a museum and a site in the house. So we're going to get to go see the Little House on the Prairie in Independence, Kansas. But a bunch of us from the show are going, and we'll have meet and greets with fans and sign autographs and all that fun stuff. And this is what we like to do. So I'll be doing that in Kansas. Where is my schedule? Let me just pull up my schedule. My friend said, I looked at your schedule, and I had to take a nap after. So I'm doing this. I get a little time off for this Memorial Day weekend. Then it's Kansas. Then I get back, and then me and a bunch of the cast, we're going to Monte Carlo. We're going to Monaco for the Monte Carlo Television Festival, and that's going to be huge. Then let's take a little break. Oh, and then I'm going to Provincetown, Massachusetts in July. I'm doing my show there, and I get home just in time to turn around and go to Walnut Grove, Minnesota, the real Walnut Grove. And we're a big fan event with the cast. Turn right around, go to Keystone, South Dakota, where you can see Mount Rushmore and the lovely Crazy Horse Monument. Uh-huh. And we're doing a big Little House thing there. Then I'm doing my show in San Francisco, August 1st.
Uh-huh.
Then I get a break in August. Yeah, it's my husband's birthday. We have to plan the party. But then I go to Connecticut. This is huge. Hartford, Connecticut, going to be a very big Little House event, and we're following it up with an event in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Then the next weekend, we're going to Johnny Cash's farm just outside Nashville. And 2 weeks later, I'm going to Salt Lake City for the huge FanX autograph show convention. And then I leave for France for a month.
Holy smokes. What vitamins do you take to keep going like that?
All of them.
You name it, you take it, right?
I find vitamin B very helpful, especially for the nerves and keeping your energy up. And it's very useful. I love taking coenzyme Q10.
Oh, yeah.
It's supposed to be good for your teeth, for the gums, and for your skin, but it's very good for cardiac health. And I find it seems to help with, you know, nerves, which with going on stage all the time is definitely important. So.
Oh, absolutely. But no, I mean, I looked at your schedule and you gave me some more in there that I didn't even see. And I'm going, holy smokes.
It's
how does she keep
crazy.
Going? Yep. But, you know, and being 62, you're young. I'm almost 78, so don't.
Oh, wow.
Let's not even go there. But, you know, you love what you do. Isn't that what keeps you going?
Well, it is. It is. I mean, that's the thing, is that I enjoy this. I mean, I've always worked. I've always performed. I've always done something. And I enjoy doing stand-up. I enjoy acting. I enjoy meeting people. And I couldn't really just stay home and do nothing. That would be crazy. And besides, my doctor, my husband and I, our doctor always says, don't retire if you can possibly not retire, really. because he says, it's just not good for you.
Aww.
He says, you know, people, they retire, they don't do anything, and, you know, they just wind up just sitting around doing nothing. And it's like the body, the brain sends a signal to the body that we're done.
Well, they say that
just
when people
not good for you.
Retire and, you know, completely from everything, don't have hobbies, no nothing.
No.
16 months, they're gone. They die.
Yeah. It just goes, my doctor said, you know, people retire. He said, but you travel or you take a part-time job.
Yeah.
You volunteer full-time. You write a book. You do something. He says, the people just sit down. Well, I don't have to do anything. Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible for your health. Yeah. So I keep going, and I really like doing it. I love performing. And it's when I was a little girl, I used to watch Carol Burnett show.
Oh,
you know,
God,
and she'd come out, she'd answer questions from the audience. And I said, now there's a job. There's a job I'd like to have. You just come out and answer questions to the audience.
Uh-huh.
And I was told, well, that's not technically a job. It is my job now. Part of my stand-up show is I have a question and answer segment. I'm basically doing the Carol Burnett gig.
Oh, I love it. What do they ask you?
Oh, my God, they ask everything. They ask normal things. I mean, they ask about, like, well, oh, good Lord, what was it like to be on the show and to work with Michael Landon and to have everyone hate you? And what is this like? And I joke about that, you know, they ask the same things all over again. You know, were you really a bitch? Was that really your hair? What was Michael Landon really like? How much did you get paid? But sometimes they ask completely crazy off-the-wall things, or they'll even ask things that are, you know, somewhat R-rated.
Yeah.
and I just find it hilarious, and I answer everything.
Talking about the wig, where did that wig come from that you wore?
Oh, my God. So, I started the show. They did try curling my hair, because Nellie has those fabulous ringlets, and my hair is straight as a pin. It just does not curl. So they get me in curlers. I had to sleep in curlers as a child and come into work 4 o'clock in the morning, get my hair, nightmare. So they're doing all this, and it won't stay. I mean, they're spraying, and the Pantene, and the Aquanets, and the thing, and the curling iron. And the poor hairdresser's having to go, oh, I've got to fix her hair, let me get the curling iron, and fix my hair all day long. And I'm miserable, because I'm sleeping in curlers, and it's just a nightmare. And they went to the producer and said, we have to get a wig. Her hair doesn't stay curled. This is a very elaborate hairdo. The grown-up actresses have wigs for these kind of hairdos. What are we thinking? Is the child going to do? So they said, done. So they brought in this guy, Ziggy Geike, wig maker to the stars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he only died quite recently. I mean, I thought he was 100 then. He lived to be very, very old. Did wigs for all the big movies. This guy comes in to make my wig. And it was he and Larry Germain, who's one of the hairdressers on Little House. And he'd worked with Betty Davis. I mean, they all worked with her. We had Marilyn Monroe's makeup man on Little House, for God's
sake. Wow.
So these guys sit down and design this whole wig from scratch. They put a plastic thing on my head and drew pictures on it of where they wanted the girls. And they got all this beautiful hair and matched it exactly to the color of my hair. Unbelievable. And they build this thing. I was told, it was one of the most expensive wigs made for a television show at that time.
No kidding.
It cost a fortune. So they said, well, we're keeping this. And they put this on my head. And, of course, as you see from then on, my curls stayed perfect even if I went down a hill in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
My hair stayed perfect 24/7. So they said, that's it, you're wearing the wig. And they readjusted it and styled it slightly differently when I got to be like 16, 17. And when I left the show, they kept it. I said, not yours, dear. They put it on that little girl, Allison Balson, who played Nancy. They put it on her head.
Oh, my God.
Nancy, when really? They stopped it, had my hair.
Well, it was expensive. They were going to throw it away.
Right, we're not giving it up. We're going to reuse it. Yeah. We're recycling this thing. So they put it on her head, which looked great. And then, of course, I come back for a guest spot for a whole thing where we meet up. And, well, they said, well, what are we going to do? Where's her wig? Her wig's on the other kid's head. And they go, well, she's married with kids. She's been away for a while. Clearly, she'd have a different hairdo.
Sure.
So they got a different wig and created this very crazy kind of Gibson girl, foofy do. And it was very fancy, but honestly, I thought it looked like a Jiffy Pop popcorn thing where my head had blown up. And everyone was like, what is on your head? That is not your hairdo. I go, well, it would have been fashionable at the time.
Yeah,
it was
very
fit the but time. Good heavens, I look very silly.
Now, you come from a very talented family. I mean, I do. It wasn't like you just decided you were going to be an actress. Your whole family was involved.
My parents met in the theater. I was supposed to be a theater child. I did. I started doing theater when I was like 13. But my parents met in the theater in Canada. And my mother went on to become Casper the Friendly Ghost.
No.
Gumby. Sweet Polly Purebred. Underdog's Girlfriend, which I really like. And Davy and Goliath. So my mother was the cartoon queen. And in the 60s, when I was a kid, watching cartoons.
No kidding. That's amazing.
I get up on Saturday morning with my cereal, and I turn on the cartoons, and like half of them are my mother.
That's so funny. I love it.
Now, you said you're a little older than me, so you may remember this. Do you remember the first family album? It was a comedy album about the Kennedys.
Yeah, I do.
It was a big hit at the time. It was like Guinness Book of World Records. It had that picture on the cover where they're supposed to be in front of the White House. They shot it in Central Park in New York and photoshopped it. Vaughn Meader was a stand-up comic who did a Kennedy impression. So it was JFK and Jackie and the kids. And it was, by today's standards, it was really soft. It was very nice.
Uh-huh.
But at the time, it was shocking to do a comedy album about a seated president, about JFK and the family and everything. And it was a huge deal. My mother was the voice of Caroline and John John.
No way. Boy,
that's the biggest comedy album in the history of Earth.
That's amazing. That's an amazing talent.
That's where she got it. She'd been doing radio, and she got that Caroline and John John, and that was it. Then she could be any. The cartoon people came to her and said, who would you like to be? You know,
wow.
Do anything you want.
But that's a talent to have, you know, to mimic voices like that. That's incredible.
You know, that was her thing. I mean, when she started radio, my parents had a hilarious story. They'd come from the theater in Vancouver, and they'd moved to Toronto and gotten jobs in radio. And they were so excited because they had a friend who knew somebody, and it was hard to break in. They knew somebody, got a job right away. So when they got there, my father had done some radio, and Stuart Baker was the other guy who worked theater with him. He'd done some radio. My mother hadn't yet. So they get there, and they're bragging about their credits, going, well, I've done this. They're trying to really get their foot in the door. And the producer asked my mother, well, what do you do? And she said, I do children's voices.
Uh-huh.
Now, my dad almost started kicking her under the table because she'd never had a job doing children's voices.
Oh.
She made that up. She said, well, what would I do if I had a job? I guess I'd be doing the job. So they said, okay. And they didn't ask her any more questions. And they interviewed her, and they interviewed them all, and they sent them home. And my father and Stuart said, why did you do that? You don't have any credits. We at least have one or two credits.
Mm-hmm.
You just, out of nowhere, said children's voices. What could you be thinking? You're going to get us in trouble. The script comes. They're all hired. They're like, oh, my God, we all got a job immediately. It was like they would do these soap operas on the radio back then. And they would go on for months, and all these characters have all these, but it was all radio. You never see anybody.
Yeah.
It's just these, and it was the same thing as soap operas. People would get divorced, and so-and-so's having an affair, and everybody so-and-so is in the hospital. It was, and some of the soap operas that are on now started in radio. It was that crazy. So they're on this radio soap opera, and they're all excited, and they're looking at it, and they said, well, how many pages? And my dad says, I'm on 3 pages. Stuart said, oh, I'm on 4 pages. And they turned to my mother, and they said, what pages are you on? And she said, all of them. I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, the soap opera plot is about a little girl from one of the families. She's very disturbed. They have to take her to a psychiatrist. And the whole plot is all the characters are, what are we going to do about the kid? And what are they going to do? And the parents arguing. And I'm playing the kid. And so they didn't know what to do. They said, "How? What are you going to do? You've never even done this before." She said, "Hey, I'll figure it out." And, of course, she was a smash, and she wound up being in almost every radio production in Toronto. She would have to, like, leave one and take a bus across town, catch the other one. And she was doing radio all day, and then they moved to New York, my father wound up on Broadway. My father was in Luther with Albert Finney, and he was in Broadway shows. And then my mother, of course, well, they had radio in New York, and then the cartoon boom started, and, well, that was it. Then she just couldn't stop working. It was craziness.
But your father also managed some real stars.
Right. So we come to California, and he decides, well, I'll go into management. I, you know, did this theater thing. I'm not, you know, he did a couple TV shows. I've actually tracked down the couple of TV shows my father had a part in, and they're, like, hilarious.
Wow. Which ones?
There was a TV show that ran for a few seasons many, many years before I was born called Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, my God.
Based on the movie. And I'm like, what? And there's my father in, like, British three-cornered hat, like a British soldier. I'm Lieutenant Lewis. I'm here about the fortress. Like, what is happening? So, yeah, he did a bunch of weird stuff. But they both were. He went into management, and he got a job working for Seymour Heller and Associates, the huge managers on Sunset Boulevard. And, well, Seymour Heller's clients included Debbie Reynolds and Liberace.
Holy smokes.
And did you see the Liberace movie they did about him?
Yeah.
Where and Dan Aykroyd played the manager, played Seymour, and he did a very good job. He was exactly like Seymour. So that's who my dad was working for.
Oh,
and
my
father was put in charge of Liberace. So Seymour said, I'll go with him to Vegas, and you take care of him in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, yeah, they were paying him a ton of money. They said, go rent a house in the Hollywood Hills near Liberace in case he needs anything, like you need to be at the house for an interview or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved to the Hollywood Hills, and we lived around the corner from Liberace.
Oh, my gosh.
And we'd go to Liberace shows when I was 8 years old. It was absolutely hilarious. Oh, my God. He was amazing. He really was good. Of course, I thought it was bonkers because my parents said, no, don't say anything, you know, because back in the 70s, they said, no one must know that Liberace is gay.
No, that's true.
I said, I'm sorry, I'm 8. I know he's gay. For heaven's sake, look at this guy. So, but he was so wonderful. And I would go, we would go trick-or-treating. All the neighborhood kids, we have to go trick-or-treating. We got to go to Liberace's house. And yeah. he would be out at a party, but he had a butler in a suit with a silver tray bring candy to the door. And it was absolutely fantastic. So I've been to Liberace's house. I went to Liberace shows. I saw the watch that's shaped like a piano and the ring that's a candelabra and the whole bit.
Women adored that man when he had his own television show. Remember that?
Yes.
And I mean,
he was a huge. Do you know the TV show that ran 15 minutes? They did that in the early days of television.
Yeah, yeah.
15-minute television show. And it was a smash. Everybody watched it.
Yes, yes. And women, they did adore him. You could tell he was gay by today's standards. Who knows back then? You know, they didn't think about that.
They sort of knew. I mean, his shows were all sold out. You know, Liberace gave us one of our most famous phrases. People will say, I laughed or all the way to the bank. I cried all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
That's Liberace. Some of the critics thought he was silly and said, what is it? This is ridiculous. This man plays the piano beautifully. He could be a classical musician. Why is he doing these ridiculous shows with all the light-up jackets and the flying over the stage and the rain? It's absurd. He's got to drive a car under the stage. This is silly. And they said his shows were terrible. Well, he never had a show that wasn't sold out.
Yeah.
They were all sold out all over the world. Yeah. They had to hold them over. He sold every ticket. And he made so much money. And he said on stage, he said, oh, when I read the review, I cried all the way to the bank. That was our Liberace. He said, oh, my God, do these people not know what I'm doing? All these women, they were crazy about him.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, hanging out at the concert. They knew. Yeah. They would say, oh, yes, he's, you know, you'd be safe with him.
They got
it. They just didn't care.
That's right. Well,
they were absolutely devoted to him. They didn't care. If you said to them, now, is Liberace gay? They'd have probably said, oh, that's terrible. Don't say that. But if you said, is Liberace going to marry you? They'd have said, well, don't be ridiculous. Of course not.
That is great.
They knew, but they didn't say it. Kind
of thing. What Liberace was? He was the Lady Gaga of his time.
Yes. Elton John. Why do you think Elton John got his whole act?
Yes.
I mean,
you're right.
Glasses, the whole thing. He was doing Elton John before Elton John was a child. And he did it all. And it was brilliant. And he was like a rock star. They absolutely loved him. He talked to the audience. And he was very clever. He talked about how he wanted to bring classical music to people who normally just got show tunes or cabaret. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, everything was very divided. You had the people who went to classical concerts and the opera, people who maybe went to musicals, and then people who just went to bars and clubs and got pop music. And then no, it didn't change. People didn't go to hear classical music. They just were never exposed to it. And he said, I'm going to play these concerts for people who normally listen to pop music or maybe show tunes, and I'm going to play classical music. I'm going to play Bach and Beethoven and everything for them.
But he made it like it was something special for them to have that. You know?
Exactly. And it was all fun. It was all just for them. Now just for you, I'm going to play. And it worked. And how many people who would not have been exposed to the classical masters.
Right. You're right.
Took an interest in that because they went to a Liberace show.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he's obsessed with educating people. It was marvelous.
Was he pretty close to George Liberace?
Yeah, he really did do that. I wish my brother George was here. So close also to his mother. That family was adored his mother. His mother adored him. And his mother, when she was older and she wasn't very well, was like in bed a lot, she had his boxes of his records under the bed. And she would sell you an album if you came to visit.
Oh, no way. Serious?
She did. She said, how do you have it? You know, I have something. I can get you one. I have some in the house. She would push his album. You must take one. She would push his merchandise and tell people to listen to his records. And
how
stuff,
funny.
Even when she told, absolutely. She was crazy about it.
Well, George was great. I mean, he had a good band. I sang with him a couple of times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, they were so proud of him. I mean, his mother thought he was going to be perhaps one of the great classical musicians of the age, and he went to a conservatory and the whole thing. But then it's like, well, I'm not quite making it here, but there's a market here for me to go do this.
You bet. Amazing.
And he was very smart, and he jumped on that, and his family, well, they couldn't have been more proud.
It's just unbelievable. You know, just knowing someone that knew Liberace and really cared. And I loved it because she did not have an easy life. Now, they came from Canada, another family from Canada. But of course, Allison was born in New York. But in 2004, on the Larry King show, the Larry King live show, she actually spoke about sexual abuse, which she experienced in her childhood by a family member. But she didn't mention the name of the abuser. But then in 2010, she came out with her book, which is still incredible. It's an autobiography called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. It is so cool. And it says, you know, how I survived Nellie Olson and learned to live being hated, basically. But she also revealed that at the age of 6, she was abused by her older brother, Stefan, and it continued for 3 years until she was cast in the movie called Throw Out the Anchor. Though the abuse ended at that point, it still affected and stayed with her for a very long time, which always does. But, you know, this is a gal who just went on. She just carried on no matter what was happening in life. Isn't that amazing how strong people can be, Ken?
She can talk.
I told you.
Wow. But, you know, she's got great stories, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I always remembered the character because of the hair.
Yeah.
And that was
expensive hair.
That was very interesting to hear. I thought that was her own hair.
I did too.
But she can talk, you know.
I could have gone on with her. I did an hour with her, but I could have talked to her for 2 or 3 hours. She had so many stories.
And maybe we can get her back.
Yeah. Several of these people I am going to try and get back just to, you know, what are you doing now? And just kind of updating, et cetera.
Right.
But the thing is that most people remember her, of course, as Nellie. She did a lot of other things and, you know, guest spots on so many different shows, et cetera. But Allison actually was more than just Nellie. She really got into activism after her, on the series, husband, Steve Tracy, passed away from AIDS or complications from AIDS. I think I'll let you let her tell you the story.
I always was a little bit. I mean, my parents laughed. They said, you've always been like this. When I was about 6 years old, you know, remember in the 60s when the Surgeon General first said smoking is hazardous to your health?
Yeah.
I was allowed to come downstairs before I went to bed to my parents' cocktail parties where people were smoking and wear my American Cancer Society visor and
no
say,
way.
The Surgeon General has determined that smoking is hazardous to your health.
How cute. I love it.
And they'd say, well, she's right, you know. We're quitting ourselves. You should be quitting. We should all be cutting back. And they said, she's not wrong. And so they let me do my social message. And they said, that's her social service message. You've all been told. And, you know, she's right. It is terrible for you. We all should be quitting. And a few of them quit. But they said, well, you know, absolutely. That's what she's doing. She's trying to say that we're having her do the Surgeon General message. So I was always doing crazy things like that. But I always did charity. So when I was on the show, there were always charity events and fundraisers to go to. And I really enjoyed that part of it, of using TV fame to help people.
Yes.
Many of the actors, and that I even knew at the time, they'd go to all these events and they would be bored. Like, I don't want to go to this stupid charity event. And I'm like, no, this is great. We're on TV and now we're helping people. This is brilliant. So I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
And I always liked doing that part of it. And so then when things started happening, when Steve Tracy, brilliant actor, played Percival, he went public with having AIDS when nobody was doing that. I mean, Rock Hudson had like just died. No one was going public and talking about this. Liz Taylor, Joan Rivers, a handful of people were doing something. It was not, there was no red ribbon. There were also no drugs as we know them today. It was all experimental treatments. And he went public. He went on TV and he went to the National Enquirer and said, yes, I'm someone who you know has been in your living room. I have AIDS. Okay. And it was a brave, brave, marvelous thing to do at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Drew a huge amount of attention to it. And so I started volunteering. I was helping him, but Steve was so lucky. His mother and his sister flew out from Florida. They took care of him. He had friends. He had, he had the resources to get a good doctor. Many people did not.
No,
and
right.
I saw so many people, their families abandoned them. So I volunteered at AIDS Project Los Angeles, and I was on the hotline and the Speakers Bureau and everything else they had to help all of these people living with HIV then and to educate people because people were frightened out of their wits. 1986, nobody knew anything. So I still go all over the country. I mean, there's still people living with AIDS in small organizations that help them, and I'm still raising money for them and doing what I can.
Good for you. You also, had, like, children's projects, too. How did you get involved with that?
Well, years ago, there was a AIDS project I worked at, a thing called Tuesday's Child, where we helped children with AIDS. And then some years ago, I was approached by a group called National Association to Protect Children, an anti-child abuse group. And I went, oh, yes. Yes, mm-hmm. I want this. Marvelous stuff. They were doing stuff legislatively, which was very new. People were saying, well, we're helping this, we're doing that, we're raising money for victims. They said, we're going to go into the Washington, D.C. and the state houses and the state capitals and actually change laws to better protect victims. I said, oh, count me in for that.
Okay.
So I joined that. It's called protect.org. And we've done a lot of stuff. We've trained people to work with the police, the ICAC teams that fight child pornography and trafficking. I mean, you name it, we've done it. And I'm president of the board of directors. Of
Good for you.
Today. And we've done so much to help fight the crime of child molestation, child pornography. We've changed laws in multiple states and at the federal level to more funding for police, all kinds of stuff. We've gotten, we have a whole technological arm, a whole tech center, the Tech Center for Child, the White Center for Child Rescue Technology. Mm-hmm. We've actually had scientists develop technology so that the police can do a better job. Because, a lot of these people on the internet, they're very clever. They're encrypting things. They're trading images and children with, and they're managing to evade the police because of the tech they can use. And we have enabled police departments to break through that and go get them.
Yeah, great. That is so great. You know what? So many young child actors couldn't make it into adulthood. You know, there were suicides, there were overdoses, all that kind of thing. How could you do? I mean, you're still going strong. I mean, your schedule was just incredible.
Right. Well, it's a lot of work. You need to stay busy. So I was always sort of had a real survivor mentality, I guess, from peasant stock, Canadian. But It is difficult. When I first got off the show at, 19, and you know, I'd gone through junior high and high school. I was still on the show. I got my braces on, my braces off my teeth. I'd moved out of my parents. I bought a condominium. I'm still on the show. Yeah. It was a little crazy to be on something that long.
Yeah.
So I'm in my early 20s, and I'm basically having a midlife crisis like I'm in my 50s because I've had an entire career. I've actually had more than one career. I started working when I was about 6.
Wow.
And when I was 10, I did a movie. And then when I was 11, I wasn't working that much. And my father actually said, well, you might not work again until after 18. Technically, Little House was my comeback. I'd already had a career.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Stopped. And then we started with Little House.
Wow. Michael
Lennon. So I had my second career. So I was now like looking for my third career at 20.
Well, you're doing darn good. Darn good. I got to ask you, though.
I was like, what am I going to do? I was doing stand-up, thank heaven. So I was able to tour, do some stuff stand-up. But it was difficult. I did the usual Love Boat and Fantasy Island. But trying to figure out, well, now who am I?
I've been
this person who's on Little House and is Nellie Olson for 8 million years. Now what?
Okay, and let me ask you, though. Who are you now?
Right. Who are you now? And I was also a cute, blonde, blue-eyed girl. And so in the 80s, everything was be a cheerleader or dead or a combination there. Naked, a cheerleader, or dead, or a combination of all three. And it was all the bimbo movies, and I wasn't cut out for that. So I'm like, what do I do? Am I the topless bimbo in this? No, that's not me. What the heck am I supposed to do? And it was so crazy. It was a very crazy time to begin with. And I thought, I'm not sure what to do with all this. Well, thank God I had to stand up. And as I said, I also did theater. I had the theater background, thank heaven. And then when I was about 22 or 3, I got heavily into activism and working with AIDS Project Los Angeles. And I literally became an employee. I was a board member and staff, Tuesday's Child, with kids with AIDS. So I was working in that. And then the stand-up really tided me over. And then what happened is somewhere in the 90s, Little House, which never really quite went away, had a massive revival. Maybe it was the DVDs, all the channels, like I Love the 70s kind of stuff going on. I don't know. But there was this explosion in the 90s, and I was doing all those Where Are They Now shows, and I Love the 70s. And I started getting recognized more in the mid-90s than I did when I was on the show. And I
said, no kidding.
What the heck's going on?
Uh-huh.
So I thought, well, this is great. So I kind of cashed in on that, and I started doing these personal appearances, and I started touring and speaking. I was doing all the speaking engagements because of my work in AIDS. So I thought, okay, fine. So I do speaking engagements. I can do this. And then I started discovering these marvelous places where Laura Ingalls really lived. I wound up visiting Walnut Grove, and I started doing the events at the official Little House sites. I said, well, this is quite a thing that's got going here. You should do this. Well, it kept going, and I wound up with a healthy, you know, touring stand-up career. And then the 2000s hit, and all of a sudden I had a new show, All True Stories, my one-woman show. All of a sudden Little House has a mega revival. I write a book. That goes bonkers. Became a bestseller. And then, of course, during the pandemic, people turned to Little House.
Yeah.
They started watching it more than ever. Famous people were talking about Little House on the Prairie on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Snoop Dogg was retweeting things, talking about the episode with Todd Bridges. It was absolutely crazy. We said, what is happening? What is happening to us? And all of a sudden, Little House was bigger than ever. I had my book. I had my stand-up show. I started doing my show online.
Oh, wow.
Everything was closed. We couldn't go out. I did online comedy pay-per-view shows. I had an online store. I sold people bonnets.
I love it.
I started reading. I said, fine, I'm stuck at home. You're all stuck at home. I'm going to read the Little House on the Prairie books. I'm going to start at the first book, chapter one, page one, and I'm going to read them live, chapter a day, every single day on Facebook. And I read for 2.5 years. I read over 600 times.
My gosh.
Live, every day.
Isn't that amazing? She just made herself over and over again and came up with these really neat ideas, which, you know, I love people who have that kind of imagination, Ken, don't you?
Yeah, you have to continually reinvent yourself in this business.
Yeah.
You know, nothing lasts very long. You know, a successful television series is 5 to 7 years, but, you know, so you continue to reinvent yourself, but she did that. A lot of people can't go beyond the series that they did, you know.
Absolutely. Then her own personal life, I think, was interesting, too. Of course, I mentioned about the sexual abuse, which, man, that goes, you know, they say, well, you get over it. No, you don't get over that. I mean, I've spoken to people, women who have been sexually abused, and it stays with you all your life. But she didn't let that be the dividing, or I should say, something that's going to make her what she is today. She just changed and went into different things and did these stand-up shows and did a whole show in French. I mean, that's incredible. But she actually was married to Donald Spencer. He was a writer. And they had, I guess they tied the knot in 1989, but 4 years later, they divorced. She was so young at that point. I mean, her first boyfriend was in 1984, right after she got done with, you know, Little House. Well, yeah, Little House on the Prairie went to 84, or 83, I should say. So 84, she had her first boyfriend that she could actually be with. And then she is married. She is married today. No kids. But she exchanged vows with a musician, Robert Paul Schoonover. I don't know, is it either Schoonover or Schoonover? I'm not sure. In 1993, it was just a small intimate ceremony. And the duo first encountered at, believe it or not, an AIDS project in Los Angeles, where she served as a volunteer after, you know, her on the air husband, Steve Tracy, passed away. And he was the director of the Southern California AIDS hotline. So, you know, it all somehow blends together. You know, that's what life is all about, isn't it, Ken? It all kind of meshes.
Go with the flow.
Yeah. You know, and if that doesn't work, I love the idea that to come up with the, you know, to do a live read during the pandemic of Little House on the Prairie. That is dynamite to come up with that. And it gave her something to do because there was not much happening during the pandemic as far as any new series or anything. That was everything shut down. So to be able to come up with that and to do it, that ain't easy to do it live every day. It wasn't like pre-taped or anything. It's sort of like what we do. You know, we just kind of kibitz about things. And I love that because it made it more real, don't you think?
Yeah, she's an amazing person, you know. I'm sure she has many, many more stories.
Oh, yes, believe me. I couldn't put them all in, to be honest with you. That's why I've got to have her back again. Maybe I can even do a part two because, I mean, you know, going an hour, and I didn't, it was the easiest interview I ever had to do because all I had to do is say, and what did you do next? And what did you do next? You know, and bam, you know, came another story. I love it.
She didn't let you ask the philosophy question or?
No, well, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Yeah. Actually, I did. But did again, you? I couldn't put the whole interview in because we have a certain amount of time here. But, you know, I'll get her back. And I promise that I will make sure that I ask her about her philosophy of life and to describe herself. I don't know if she can answer that question because she's made herself over so many times. Right. She's not one person. She's multiple people.
Does she live in L.A.?
I think she's still in L.A. I'll have to find out. Because I didn't have a whole lot of updated material on her. So, but I will find out because I still got her phone number someplace. The neat part of this is that I work with this one person in Los Angeles that had a lot of stars in his, you know, bailiwig. I'd always had the numbers, their home numbers to call them. Because he used to say, well, I'll have them call you and I don't know. I need to call them because, you know, it's the time constraints. I didn't like to have people wait online, you know, if we had a news break or whatever, or a commercial break. So I would always say, no, I need to call them. Well, home numbers, which, I mean, that was a little on the sneaky side, but that's okay. I mean, because I was very, very careful.
Today it would be their cell phone number.
Yeah, cell phone number.
Yeah.
But the thing is, home number, cell phone number, I was very careful. I mean, even when I would throw away papers or something, I would always destroy anything that had their phone numbers on it because it, that's sacrosanct. They trusted me with those numbers. And I appreciated, you know, what they had to go through. And it's enough when they would walk down the street and people stop you. You don't want crazy people calling you on the phone. You know what I mean? Right. So, but anyway, wasn't she a kick?
I really enjoyed it. She's quite a talker.
Well, she's a spitfire. She fit the, well, not that she was a hated person for real, but it's her spitfire attitude that really made Nellie come alive. And just to do that for, you know, from 74 to 83, that's a lot of spitfire to put up with. But I loved her. And she was just so sweet. At the end of the interview, which I didn't have because I cut and pieced some of this stuff together, I asked her if she would come back. And she said, anytime, you know, I'll be glad to. So a lot of these people were very, very sweet to say. And, you know, sometimes they say, oh, well, they all say they'll come back again. But you can hear in their voice whether they really mean it. And most of the people that said that they were coming back or would come back, I mean, you know, we've had Donnie Most and Ansel Williams and all these people, they all said, yeah, anytime. And they really meant it. They really did mean it. So that's, you know, our next thing. Well, I don't know. I was going to say that's our next stage of pop star talk, but it's not because I've got so many more interviews that I'm transferring. Are you ready for this, Ken? A lot of them are still on old-fashioned cassettes. So I have to have them changed over to what they call MP3s so we can do edits and all that.
Digitizing.
So, yeah, it's just, it's incredible. I got a stack. And I haven't even gone through all of them yet. Right. Literally. I've still got drawers full of them. It's like, oh my gosh. And some of them, honestly, I forgot that I even did. Peter Marshall, he used to do a lot of the game shows. Pat Sajak, who till recently did Wheel of Fortune. And all these people, and I'm going, Mickey Rooney. It's been so fun. I go back and I'm going, did I do that? Yeah, I did that interview way back when. But they're all going to be part of Pop Star Talk, I promise.
All right. Well, it's been fun.
It absolutely has been. And, of course, Allison's energy still goes on today because she truly loves what she does, as I do, and Ken, and our engineer, Greg. So till our next time together, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and you too can dare to dream.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.